Salve podcast listeners. A quick update that the fundraising for When in Rome Series 4 is still alive on Kickstarter. It's reached its funding goal, but if you'd still like to contribute and get your hands on a quotation fingers valued limited edition coffee mug, now's your chance. When in Rome exists due to the generosity of the supporters, so sincerely thank you to everyone who has contributed to the campaign so far. I've posted links to the Kickstarter campaign on social media, and you can also find it if you go to Kickstarter and search for When in Rome. Thanks very much, and here's the podcast. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Peter Davis, Visiting Research Fellow in Classics at the University of Adelaide. This is episode CXII, The Book of Love. The Roman poet Ovid penned the Book of Love in three volumes as a manual for how to deal with the art of love and seduction during the slightly austere days of the reign of Augustus. Now, be forewarned, the book isn't exactly men are from the Temple of Mars and women are from the Temple of Venus, so happy Lupercalia, I guess? Here's Peter Davis.
Ovid was born in March in 43 BCE, so the year after Julius Caesar was assassinated, so he's born during that period of the civil wars. He's about 12 when Octavian wins the Battle of Actium, and so Augustus comes to power. He died in either 17 or 18 CE, we don't know which year it was. But the pivotal event in his life occurred in 8 CE, which was the year in which he was exiled or technically relegated to Tomis on the Black Sea in what is now Romania. So, as I say, the pivotal event is that his major work, the greatest work, which I certainly accept that it's his greatest work, is Metamorphoses. But before he wrote Metamorphoses, Ovid started out as a love poet. And he wrote love elegy in the traditional way, in a way that had become traditional in the Augustan period. That is, he wrote about his love life. And it's conventional for the poet to write about his mistress, and he always has a bad time with her. She's always giving him a hard time, which, of course, leads to interesting situations. The other aspect of love poetry is that it's written in a particular meter, the elegy couplet. So it's written in a couplet consisting of 6 feet and then 5 feet. So Ovid starts out with a collection called the Amores, in which his girlfriend Corinna is important. He then moves to, and this I think is quite interesting in context of what's happening in relation to the reception of the Odyssey at the moment. He writes a collection of poems which are letters sent by mythological heroines to their absent husbands or lovers. And I mentioned the Odyssey because the very first one is a letter in which Penelope writes to Odysseus or Ulysses and says, "Why aren't you here, mate?" And there's a series of these. So Dido writes to Aeneas, Briseis, Achilles, slave mistress, she writes to Achilles, and so on.
So is this during his young days?
This is in his earliest years. And I mentioned the Odyssey because at the moment, I mean, Margaret Atwood wrote a novel about the Odyssey from Penelope's perspective. A recent novel has been written about the Odyssey from Circe's perspective.
From
the perspectives of various women.
So that they're following Ovid was in already Ovid's
there.
Footsteps.
Ovid had already done that.
Yeah.
And that was at the last decade of the...
Of course, you could also see it as fan fiction.
Absolutely.
I wrote some very bad Star Trek fan fiction in my early days.
So. I think that's right. And I think you could see a lot of that literature as fan fiction, actually. I really like it.
The time that he was writing in then,
sure.
I suppose Rome was really just trying to find its feet as an empire and maybe just trying to figure out what sort of empire it's going to be.
I think that's a good way of looking at it. In 31 BCE, Octavian finally defeats Mark Antony and Cleopatra, and the civil war's over. There's finally a winner. And so Octavian Augustus sets about building up the new system and installing himself as the princeps, the first citizen, and finding his way towards building an autocracy, a Julian dynasty. But of course, it's not just about that. There's also a program. In particular, what's relevant here for us is that there's a moral program. Mm. And Augustus sees part of Rome's problem as being instability in family life. And in particular, I think he's concerned about the way Roman women are behaving. And so in 17 CE, he passes a series of moral laws. And in particular, for the very first time in Roman history, adultery became a crime. And I mention this as being about controlling women because adultery is defined in terms of the status of the woman.
Mm. Mm.
So we're talking about a slave-earning society. So it's okay, in inverted commas, for a freeborn Roman citizen male to have sex with a slave. That's not regarded as problematic because the slave is personal property. But it's different when it comes to the women. Augustus is concerned that marriage be protected and that freeborn, respectable women behave properly.
Mm.
And so the marriage legislation is directed towards controlling the behavior of married women. And that's relevant to the Ars Amatoria because Ovid draws attention to that several times.
Yeah, and sorry, that's the Latin title for the Art of Love.
Sorry, yes, yeah. Ars Amatoria is normally translated as Art of Love. Ars means technique or skill as well as art. It covers all of that territory. So you could call it technique of love, erotic skills, something like that.
Yeah.
But the important point is that for a Roman audience, that suggests that this is a kind of teach-yourself book.
Yeah, yeah, instruction manual.
An instruction manual,
exactly. I saw the word didactic applied to it.
That's right. Didactic means teaching.
Yeah, that'd usually be how to rotate a crop, how to farm something.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a tradition of didactic poetry in Roman literature already. Virgil wrote a poem on agriculture in four books in the 30s.
Yeah.
And before that, in the 50s, Lucretius wrote a poem in six books setting out the theories of Epicurus.
So that's the instruction manual that they needed then. But now a new Rome needs the Art of Love from Ovid, or doesn't exactly need it.
I'm not sure that it
gets it.
Yes, I'm not sure that it needs it. Yeah. And I'm surely, from the emperor's point of view, it didn't need it.
But he's writing that against the backdrop of a new Roman Empire with these new sensibilities coming in, which he's going to have to deal with in the content.
I think that all of those things that we've mentioned are pertinent here. One is, as you say, that there is this new Roman Empire and Augustus a particular program. Also, the poem can be seen as a kind of hybrid. Yes, it's a didactic poem, but also it's an elegiac poem. It uses the elegiac meter and the subject is love.
Mm.
So all of those things, I think, figure when it comes to Art of Love, to Ars Amatoria.
The text as it is accessible by us, what is a good translation if a listener would like to go and get a copy of The Art of Love?
The one that I currently favour is by Julia Dyson Hayduk, H-E-J-D-U-K. I'm not sure how you pronounce that name. And it's called something like The Art of Offence, published by University of Wisconsin Press.
It's The Offence of Love.
The Offence of Love, thank you.
And it collects a few of Ovid's works.
It has Ars Amatoria in it, the three books of The Art of Love.
Mm.
And it also has in it Tristia II. The Tristia is a collection of poems that Ovid wrote from exile. And the poem that I'm calling Tristia II is a verse letter that he wrote to the emperor.
Mm.
Be allowed to come back to Rome, yes, or at least be sent somewhere better than Thomas,
yes,
the Black Sea.
Yeah, he didn't enjoy his time
there. He hated it.
Yeah.
Of course, neither Augustus nor Tiberius relented, and so he died there. Another one which is generally available, and is pretty good actually, is by Peter Green in The Penguin.
So how is The Art of Love structured? It's three books. What are the themes that he's working on there?
Yes, as you say, it's a poem in three books. The first two books seem to have been composed as a unit, and the first two books are addressed to men.
Mm-hmm.
So book one gives instructions in how to find a girlfriend. Then in the second half of book one, he is concerned with how to approach a girlfriend, how to woo and win her over.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second book concerns how to keep the girlfriend, how to make it a long-lasting relationship. The third book, this is disputed, everything is, was almost certainly added afterwards, and it's addressed to women.
Yeah.
And tells women how to behave, how to deal with these young men who've been instructed in books one and two.
Mm. It might do at this point. Can you bring up the text and we'll read through?
Sure.
The start of book one.
Yep.
And take us through this, a bit of the
text. So here are the first few lines. Should anyone here in Rome lack finesse at lovemaking, let him try me, read my book, and results are guaranteed. Technique is the secret, and technique is ours. Charioteer, sailor, oarsman, all need it. Technique can control love himself. As Automedon was charioteer to Achilles, and Tiphys Jason steersman, so I, by Venus' appointment and made love's artificer, shall be known as the Tiphys, the very Automedon of love. So the poem addresses itself to anyone in Rome who is ignorant of lovemaking. And of course, this book is particularly addressed to men.
Mm. He kind of puts forward his credentials there as well.
One of the interesting things about that is that it's going back to Hesiod. Hesiod, who wrote didactic poetry, reckoned that the Muses had appeared to him on Mount Helicon. So Ovid says, nor shall I falsely ascribe my arts to Apollo. No airy bird comes twittering advice into my ear. I never had a vision of the Muses herding sheep in Ascra's valleys, which is where Hesiod came from.
Mm.
This work is based on experience. What I write, believe me, I have practiced. My poem will deal in truth. Now that claim, I have to say, what I write, believe me, I have practiced, that's one that came back to bite him.
Yes.
To say that it's based on experience. It's a good approach if you're writing a didactic text, but in the context, it might be somewhat unwise.
And how does he address the female audience in book three? What's the start of that?
Well, what's interesting about that is that one of the ideas that's going through the whole poem is the military motif, which I suppose is not surprising in ancient Rome. So in the first two books, one notion has been that the lover is a kind of soldier who's after plunder and the woman is the plunder. Another idea is that there's a war between the sexes. And that's the idea that he picks up at the beginning of book three. So he says, I've armed Greeks against Amazons. And of course, Amazons are female warriors.
Mm-hmm.
Now I must fashion weapons for Penthesilea. She's the queen of the Amazons. And her girls. A well-matched fight is best, with victory granted, through the favour of kind Venus and Venus' earth-girdling son. Unfair for naked ladies to meet armed troops. A victory gained that way would disgrace our gallants.
So need to put them on more even footing so that it's a fair fight.
Exactly so.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
When you go through The Art of Love, there's general topics and themes that come out and different recommendations. So you can read about not forgetting a girl's birthday, letting her miss you, but not for too long. And these are all good things that we need to remember now. Trust me, remember the birthday. And you don't ask a girl about her age. That's not
that's
the polite
right.
thing to
and
do.
You don't make unpleasant comments about her appearance.
Yes.
I mean, there's...
I wish I had Ovid when I was younger.
There is all kinds of advice that might be said is practical. So there's advice on grooming, for example, so that the man should be clean and good-looking, but not be too fussy, so that he should comb his hair, but don't put it in curlers.
Mm.
Make sure that his sandals are fitting properly. It's advisable to have a good suntan. I guess that's because Roman men in particular were mainly outdoors.
Yeah.
Make sure you're attentive to her when she's sick. He also gives advice which contradicts the advice I just gave you about looking suntanned. He says it's also good for a lover to look pale. And that's a convention that comes from elegiac poetry. The
okay.
lover represents him sick and as pale and sort of wasting away. So he recommends both of those things. There's a profound issue. Should you approach the maid? I mean, see, obviously that woman has a certain social status.
Mm.
Should you approach the maid? And then, yes, it's a good idea to approach the maid. Should you sleep with the maid? Well, no, that's not a good idea. And then he goes through a whole series of arguments and then it comes out, yes, it is a good idea to sleep with the maid.
So he talks himself around then, does he?
He talks himself around. So there's all kinds of advice. It's a good idea to lose at games when you're playing with your girlfriend.
I've done that.
But then he gives that same advice to women in book three.
Yes.
It's advisable to women to lose. So the lovers are sort of competing to lose.
Yeah, yeah.
There are bigger issues at stake here.
Can you take me through a bit of it? There was a lot in there that I found interesting, but just as a bit of a representative Book 1, 67 to 88. Let's go through suggested venues for meeting girls.
Yeah, this I think is really interesting because they're not the sorts of venues that you might expect. So here's what to do, he says. When the sun's on the back of Hercules' lion, now that means in summer, specifically July, and you need to ask yourself, so why is July called July?
Julius.
Well, it's named after Julius. Stroll down some shady colonnade. Pompey's say that is a part of the Theatre of Pompey.
Mm.
It is, in fact, the place where Julius Caesar was assassinated. And he says in Latin, Pompeia sub umbra, which is beneath Pompey's shade or beneath Pompey's ghost. And if you remember your Shakespeare, Caesar was killed at the foot of Pompey's statue.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's an interesting choice of a venue for meeting women. Or Octavia's for her dead son Marcellus, extravagant marble facings, RIP. So this is the colonnade of Octavia. Octavia is Augustus' sister. And Marcellus was envisaged as his heir. Or Livia's, Emperor's wife, of course, with its gallery of genuine old masters. Or the Danaids' portico. The Danaids' portico is connected to the Temple of Palatine Apollo. So Palatine Apollo, Augustus' house, was attached to the Temple of Apollo on the Palatine.
Mm.
And it was a major building, and it was dedicated in 29 BCE. And as I say, it's effectively part of Augustus' house. Note the artwork. Danaus' daughters plotting mischief for their cousins, father attitudinizing with the drawn sword. So what's interesting here is that he chooses public monuments that are particularly associated with the regime. And the analogy that I would draw would be in an Australian context. If you imagine that someone said, well, look, if you want to meet girls, I suggest you try Old Parliament House. Or what about the War Memorial, the National Gallery of Australia, or the High Court? These are big public monuments associated with the government. These are not obvious places for pickup artists.
But back in those days, you've got different contexts for what public monuments were to Rome, I suppose. And maybe he's suggesting a certain type of girl that is maybe someone that you can keep long-term.
Oh, it's possible.
Picking up tourists who are out looking for a good time. I don't know. Man, I'm trying to justify Ovid here. I'm reaching.
Well, I think he's having a bit of fun with the Augustan monuments. Here's another one. I'm skipping a bit. The very courts are hunting grounds for passion. Amid lawyers' rebuttals, love will often be found. Here, where under Venus' marble temple, the Appian fountain pulses its jets high in the air, your jurisconsult's entrapped by love's beguilements. Counsel to others, he cannot advise himself. Venus Marble Temple with the Appian Fountain, that's the temple of Venus Genetrix, and it's located in the form of Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
So again, it's another Caesarian monument.
Just aside from the art of love, it gives an interesting picture of how Romans interacted with those monuments and even what monuments there were and some of the features that they had, because we don't have those anymore, really.
No, that's true. One of the things about this poem, but not just this one, is that they do actually constitute some of the evidence that we have for these particular monuments. So the description of the Danaid portico, for example, that I read out, that's important evidence for reconstructing that monument.
Mm, mm. And we always associate those monuments with veneration and ritual and Senate meetings and everything, but also picking up girls. That's something else that we can add to what Rome did. You can now add this to your
picture of what these monuments were about.
Well, it's good. It's good. It puts some more,
It makes them human.
Yes, it makes a human face on the Romans.
Yeah.
The other places that he has as being good to pick up girls is to go to the Circus Maximus, to the races. He would have loved the Colosseum if that was around. That would have been a chick magnet,
perfect. You can certainly say that. You can certainly, he recommends a theatre, but he just argues for the theatre on the basis that's where Romulus' rape of the Sabine women took place, which is a kind of strange argument. But as you say, the next one is Circus Maximus. In fact, he had written a poem in the Amores about his experience sitting next to a girl at the Circus Maximus. And in fact, some of the advice that he gives here in Art of Love, like flick away bits of dust from the girl, whether the dust is there or not. That already...
Just to get her attention?
That's right.
Can you take me through the triumph? So he says a triumph is a good place to pick up girls. So it's 1, 213 to 228.
Just leading into that, he talks about a good place was... This is not as much an event as a place, is there was a mock sea battle held in the Vatican Valley.
Mm.
And this was part of the celebrations for the Temple of Mars Altar, Mars the Avenger, in 2 BCE. It's a big, big year. It's the year this poem is supposed to have come out. Then he imagines young Gaius Caesar, who was only 18 at the time, going off to fight the Parthians and coming back victorious. And so we have the triumph. The day will come, most splendid of beings, he's addressing Gaius Caesar, the day will come, most splendid of beings, when you'll ride in gold behind four snow-white steeds, preceded by captive chieftains, fetters about their necks to prevent the flight that brought them safety before. Cheering youths will look on, and girls beside them, a day to make every heart run wild for joy. And when some girl inquires the names of the monarchs, or the towns, rivers, hills portrayed on the floats, answer all her questions, and don't draw the line at questions only. Pretend you know, even when you don't. Here comes Euphrates, tell her, with reed-fringed brow. Those dark blue tresses belong to Tigris, I fancy. There go Armenians. That's Persia. That is some upland Achaemenid city. Both those men there are generals. Give the names if you know them. If not, invent.
Yeah.
It must be said, it's an imaginary triumph. And in fact, the campaign never happened. And what happened was a negotiated peace between the Parthians and the Romans.
Mm.
And poor Gaius Caesar died in 4 CE. So I suspect this was written before 4 CE. But you get an image of a triumph.
Yeah, it's good advice for picking up girls if a triumph ever comes along.
If there's a triumph,
yeah,
it's a great place for meeting girls.
This could be something that would get him in trouble with Augustus, really.
The triumph is a very important Roman institution, and it's very important for Augustus. And in fact, under Augustus, triumphs are eventually limited to being held by members of the imperial family.
Mm.
Every general who goes out and wins a victory is fighting in the name of Augustus. It's difficult to define precisely what's going on here, but I certainly think he's having fun at the expense of major cultural institutions, major places associated with the regime. It's a book that's intent on amusing and getting the reader to laugh.
Yeah. Can we turn to book three now and have a look at some of the advice that he gives to women? Now, I went through it and there was quite a lot of it that I found myself overly critical of women about how they should be treating their appearance. So one example, if you want to go to book three, line 280, where he starts to talk about how to laugh in a charming fashion.
Yeah, so he's been giving advice on grooming and how to cover up physical faults and what colours to wear.
And how to do their hair.
How to do the hair.
And he keeps coming back to how to do your hair.
He's clearly got a thing about hair. Yeah, yeah. There's a poem in the Amores about Corinna. She dyes her hair too much and it all falls out. So he criticises her for that. Yes, but the bit you're talking about, so he says, let's just start a little bit earlier. Bad breath. You should never converse on an empty stomach and keep your mouth well back from your lover's face.
Mm.
If your teeth are decayed or horsey or protruding, a guffaw can cost you dear. Believe it or not, girls even learn how to laugh. In their quest for decorum, this is one more skill they must acquire. Don't open the mouth too wide. Control those dimples. Keep your teeth concealed behind your lips. Don't split your sides with endless hilarity, but rather laugh in a restrained, a ladylike way. Some women distort their features with lopsided guffaws. Some so cross-eyed there with mirth, you'd swear they were weeping. Others utter harsh, unlovely braying noise, like a she-ass hitched to a mill. It's not very flattering.
Mm.
Where does art not enter? Girls learn to make even tears attractive, to cry when and how they please. He certainly gives advice to men about how to behave, but really he's much more controlling about women. I mean, when it comes to grooming, remember I said that the grooming for men is fairly casual.
Yes.
But when it comes to women, there's far more detail about how women need to dress, do their hair, put on their makeup. And in fact, He wrote a poem about makeup, which he mentions here.
Mm.
And there's far more detail about what a woman needs to do.
And I guess you see that when you've got pictures or mosaics of high-ranked women getting ready. They'll have four attendants doing their hair at once. So this was in the realm of possibility,
oh,
I suppose,
absolutely.
To have
this much
attention.
If you're dealing with the upper-class women, yeah. That is certainly the case.
So the other thing that I found interesting about Book 3 is that he does try and give helpful advice too about how to deal with men or how to choose a good man. So here, if you could go to Not Trusting Well-Groomed Men, line 433.
So I'm still using the Penguin, but the translation is slightly different. Keep clear of smart young beaux who make elegance a profession. Flaunt handsome profiles are always fixing their hair. The tale they'll tell you they've told to 1,000 girls already. They're fancy free. Never stick to a constant love. What's a woman to do when her lover's smoother than she is and probably has more men on the side as well? It's hard to believe, but true, that Troy would still be standing if the Trojans had followed poor Cassandra's advice. That fits in with the advice that he gave to men, that is, that they shouldn't be too attentive to their appearance. So he tells women to avoid men who are too attentive to their appearance. And one of the suggestions, too, that he makes about, and this is not quite PC, of course, one of the things he suggests about men who are too fussy about their appearance is that they might be effeminate. That's what he says here.
Mm.
The man might have men on the side as well. That's the kind of man that a woman should avoid.
So when this book came out, you had the Augustan marriage legislation come out in about 17?
That's right.
So how did what this book was recommending for tactics and advice, how did that gel with those kind of ideals?
It clearly doesn't gel at all. One of the interesting aspects of the poem is that in each of the three books, Ovid makes it clear that, or at least tries to make it clear, that the poem is not addressed to married women.
Mm.
He actually invokes the law. He shows that he is aware of the law. I'm talking about book 131, Aid My Enterprise, Venus, Respectable Ladies, the kind who wear headbands and ankle-length skirts, that means respectable married women, Roman matrons, are hereby warned off. Safe, love, legitimate liaisons will be my theme. This poem breaks no taboos. The Latin for that is that he says that there is no crimen, no crime, in carmine. Carmen is Latin for song or poem. There's no crimen in carmine, which makes for a great jingle. But one way of looking at it is actually crimen is in carmine. The letters are there.
Yes.
It's just
so he's intentionally having some wordplay there.
There's no doubt there's wordplay going on there.
Yeah.
And then the same is true. This is from book 3 now, line 611. I was going to omit the ways of eluding a crafty husband or vigilant guard. Let the bride respect her husband. Let brides be guarded securely. That's proper, modesty, law, and our leader so prescribe. But watch you, a woman still scarcely used to her freedom? Intolerable. Let me instruct you all, and so on. So the claim is this book is not addressed to respectable married women. This is addressed to freed women, and those women are not covered by the law. And so it's not promoting adultery.
Yeah.
But of course, no author can control the readership.
I was about to say, you can't stop somebody from picking it up.
How do you do that? The husband is reading it and the wife picks it up.
Yep.
So
somebody's going, look at this, Augustus.
It's quite. And so it's really not persuasive. So that interests you too, we have this.
This is the letter that he wrote while in exile.
This is the letter that is addressed to Augustus. So should I be surprised that amid this mass of such great matters you never unroll the scroll of my jokes? And yet if by chance, as I would have preferred, you'd had the time, you would not have read any crime in my art. Of course, I admit that it wasn't written with stern face, not worthy to be read by so great a prince. But still, it doesn't on that account advise and instruct Roman wives to break the commands of the laws. And so you could have no doubt about its intended audience. Book 1 of 3 has the following four verses. Get ye far hence, slender fillets, badges of modesty, and you, long hem, who reach halfway down the foot. I'll sing only what's lawful and permissible affairs. There'll be nothing criminal in my song.
Mm.
So didn't I strictly exclude every woman from this art whose robe and fillet say that she's off limits? In other words, he actually quotes the beginning of Ars Amatoria 1, Book 1, in the defence. And I find it hard not to draw the conclusion that he actually wrote that section in Book 1 of Art of Love with a view to defence if it was needed later on.
Mm. And he does say that he was banished for a poem and a mistake.
A poem and a mistake.
Carmen et Era.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So this is again from Tristia 2. This is line 207 and following. Though two crimes have ruined me, a song and a mistake, Carmen et Error, I need to keep quiet about the guilt of the second one. He can't talk about the error, the mistake. Caesar, it's more than my life is worth to reopen your wounds. To have grieved you once already is way too much. The first part of my case remains, that through a disgraceful song, I'm charged with teaching filthy adultery. The error is something that, because people write books about, because it's great field of speculation, we really don't know what the mistake was. But he does say this in Tristia 2, this is at 103 and following. Why did I see that something? Why did I make my eyes guilty? Why was that fault made known to me, all unawares? Actaeon didn't mean to see Diana naked. That didn't make him a prey for his dogs any less. So he refers to the myth of Actaeon, which is a story in which Actaeon accidentally sees Diana in the nude.
Mm.
And she punishes him by transforming him into a stag, and the stag is devoured by his own dogs. The suggestion is that the other crime was seeing something, but we don't know what it was. But we do have the poem, and the poem is the other half of the story.
When you give this book to a modern audience then, or you teach it in a modern context, have you taught this as a text before?
Yeah, I have. I used to teach it in the 90s and the early 2000s.
Yeah. How do you make it more relevant to a modern audience? How do you communicate that while this is good insight and some of this is good relevant advice, some of this might not gel well with what we think today?
Some of it must be said, and we haven't really touched on this, some of this material is difficult. It was difficult then.
I see it's even more difficult now. I see that's how he uses myth as well to communicate tough concepts. So he'll talk about the rape of the Sabine woman, or he'll bring up Greek myth.
That's right.
And it's a way of covering what the Romans would find tricky concepts or ideas.
That's right. I mean, the Sabine women story is interesting. It's part of the foundation story of Rome.
Yeah.
But it's a story of a rape. Now, Livy tells that story. Livy, the contemporary, you know, Livy's alive at the same time as Ovid. Livy tries to justify what Romulus had done. Ovid plays it for laughs. There is no attempt at justification whatever.
Mm.
There are other episodes that are, I think, even more difficult. And as you say, it's done with Greek myth. So that he recommends that the lover try tears. We're talking about Book 1 now. And then he talks about a little bit of sort of rough horseplay. And then he moves to what is actually rape.
Mm.
And so he tells the story of Achilles' rape of Deidamia. So this is a story from before the Trojan War. Achilles' mother doesn't want him to go to the Trojan War, so she dresses him up as a woman and takes him to the island of Scyros. And there he meets Deidamia, a young princess, and dressed as a woman, he rapes her. And Ovid is absolutely explicit in the language here. He uses the word wis. Well, apparently in the time of Julius Caesar, a law was passed on public force or violence, de vi publica. And one of the things it did was made criminal stuprum, which is some kind of sexual crime.
Mm.
And there was a crime, stuprum per whim, which means a violent sexual assault. And Ovid uses both of those terms, stuprum, twice, and they're the only times he uses that word in his entire works. And he uses wis, which means violence or force, several times in that episode. So he's clearly recommending what is illegal.
Mm.
This is a crime under Julian legislation, whether it's Julius Caesar or Augustus. So this is an episode that is very difficult to deal with. What is interesting, I think, is that in the past, say, until the 1980s, Ovid's episodes involving rape have often been treated as if they were episodes of seduction, that is, involving persuasion.
Okay.
There's no persuasion here.
Yeah.
And his language could not be more explicit in legal terms than the language he uses in this story of Achilles and Deidamia. Now, I think the story is meant to be outrageous, but it doesn't make it any easier to handle.
But I guess that, you know, when you're teaching it, you've got to teach that because that's part of it.
If you're teaching the art of love, you can hardly ignore it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, in fact, I think, say it's distressing, that apparently this is a work that's become quite popular with the alt-right in the United States.
Is it really?
Because it can be seen as a poem advocating the subjection of women.
Mm.
Metamorphoses has already become somewhat difficult. I think that's a completely different story myself in terms of the way it represents rape, but it's highly problematic. And there are places in the United States where trigger warnings are applied. So if you're reading this text, be aware that there is, you know, sensitive material here.
Mm. How would you like people to approach this text then, if you were teaching it now?
Art of Love.
Mm.
One way of approaching it is to look at it in terms of the representation of gender, the way in which men and women are supposed to behave. And there's instruction, training about how women are meant to behave and how men are meant to behave. And this is the aspect I've focused on in the past. Look at it in terms of the politics of the regime, how Ovid views the regime, how he views the moral legislation and so on. But I think that you have to face up to episodes that may be problematic. All the texts that we teach are complicated and difficult.
Mm.
So I guess that's how I would approach it.
That was Peter Davis, a visiting research fellow in classics at the University of Adelaide, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review, as always, very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Peter on Twitter. Peter is at PeterJDavis2, I am at NightlightGuy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for When in Rome. In the next episode, I kid you not, you're sitting down, you ready? Caracalla. Apologies it took us so long. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been both fantastic and incredibly patient. And thanks for listening.